Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Charlie Chaplin, which goes all the way back to the beginnings of film. And I guess we're going to start off by talking a little bit about his history and his humble origins, starting off in Great Britain, in Victorian music halls, kind of following his mom on stage. And if you watch the movie Chaplin, which is a movie about him starring Robert Downey Jr. as Chaplin, you'll get a lot of this background that we're going to be talking about. You can see from the examples in the movie Chaplin that those early experiences in the Victorian music halls and growing up in poverty and struggling, you could see sort of his character of the tramp being shaped even back then. What do you think, Mike?
I think you're absolutely right, but a quick qualifying note is that in some ways, ironically, Chaplin's the least reliable source for information about his childhood. In his autobiography, which I always smile at this, is the title of his autobiography is My Autobiography, lest you think he's writing somebody else's autobiography. He published it in 1964 and gives a very full account of his childhood. But in other places, articles, interviews, various information about Chaplin and from Chaplin, he gave various accounts of childhood. They don't always match up. And biographers since then have taken him to task for perhaps overstating the poverty we're talking about. There was poverty. There was hardship. That's without doubt. But he tended to embellish a bit. Or, you know, again, he's a creative artist and the creativity extended to his accounts of his childhood. But what we know securely is that both of his parents were music hall performers, very much Victorian into Edwardian era music hall performers. And then there's really a great deal of sadness there within the family. For one thing, Chaplin always had insecurity as to whether his official father was really his father. And so there was Chaplin, his older brother, Sidney, who in later life would be his business manager and get bit parts, bit roles in the movies, the two of them and the parents. The father disappeared very quickly. He had a severe alcohol problem, did have a stage career, which he kept going, but had that alcohol problem and basically abandoned them, left them. So the two boys are left with their mother. And she was a fairly gifted music hall performer by most accounts, but she had severe mental health issues. Now, our clinical designations today are not always going to match up with how people describe things then, but it seems like she was schizophrenic. We don't know for sure because, again, this is like, you know, turn of the 20th century, what the doctor said. But in effect, her mental balance was not balanced. In other words, she really was wildly unpredictable in terms of moods and behaviors and eventually was sent to, you know, the loony bin, as they would have said, you know, pejoratively, you know, the insane asylum. And that's a whole extended story unto itself. But the fact that there was great instability there within the marriage, which busted up, both parents troubled that way. And you're absolutely right. That kind of insecurity directly fed into the formation of the tramp character. Now, where things are a little less secure in terms of what we know, Chaplin always talked about it as what we would call a Dickensian childhood, right? You know, great poverty, a kind of Cockney accented thing. And that's all true enough. But his biographers, including Kenneth Lynn, who's done an exceptional job of showing, well, here's what Chaplin says in the autobiography, and here's what we know. And they don't always match up completely. So yes, there was poverty, but maybe not quite as dire as Chaplin, but maybe more lower middle class rather than like abject poverty. But those are like gradations of poverty, right? So it's sort of strange to have that discussion. But the fact that Chaplin came out of that and always identified with that, and always, I think, for all his millions of dollars later in life, I think was always a bit insecure. That would explain why, among other reasons, he wanted to make so much money. When you grow up not having much, he really, really was very business savvy, very much wanting to make the money. And then that profound irony of this fabulously rich man playing a poor guy, playing a tramp. And that's a part of the character as well, which we can talk about. But the long and the short of it is that he really did have that kind of relatively grim upbringing. And to your point earlier, it absolutely feeds into the formation of the tramp character.
If you watch the movie Chaplin, you'll see his daughter, Charlie Chaplin's actual daughter, Geraldine Chaplin, playing her grandmother. So you'll see a little bit of what Mike and I were just talking about. In terms of Chaplin's attitude towards money, it is said that long after he became a millionaire, he continued to live in a shabby hotel room and kept his studio checks in a trunk for months and said, "The saddest thing I can imagine is to get used to luxury." So you can see how much he might have embrace that character of the tramp as being sort of an everyman and maybe even a cautionary tale, like he's broken, he's always down and out, but there's something essentially sweet about the tramp, which I think is the saving grace for people who don't relate to the tramp literally. They at least relate to him emotionally.
Well, you know, Chaplin was funny this way, that he could be really lavish with his spending on some things, but really tight in other ways. And in his circle of friends, he was notorious for somehow never having cash on him. So when they went out to restaurants, he was always asking his friends to pick up the tab. Meantime, this guy could have bought them out 100 times over, right? But, you know, wealthy people can be that. Like, why are they wealthy? Well, they hold on to their money. And he held on to it that way. But his life is riddled with contradictions, just as the very character of the tramp actually has its share of ambiguities and contradictions. And you see that running throughout Chaplin's life. And we'll double back on this, but in terms of his relationships with women and so on, you know, in the films and in his private life, it's a really complicated scenario in a lot of ways. But why don't you, let me hand off back to you, because let's talk a bit about his actually getting into show business and then into a film career.
Well, he started off, you know, really in vaudeville, which is kind of a good place to get started since movies hadn't been invented yet. And then once they started to come into play and he came to the United States, there's some fun facts to know and tell. Stan Laurel was his understudy on the English stage. And when Stan Laurel and Chaplin moved to America, they shared a room in a boarding house. But he never mentioned Stan Laurel even once in his autobiography, but there's an apocryphal tale that cooking was not allowed in the boarding house where they stayed. So Chaplin would play the violin to cover up the sound of Laurel frying up food on a hot plate. I'm amazed this never made it into one of their skits, because that's just made for that kind of a send up in a funny way.
But again, the puzzling contradictions in Chaplin's private life and professional life. He could be intensely loyal to certain friends and employees. Stan Laurel, you're right, goes back to those earliest showbiz days, and they were friends. But you read the autobiography, and you want to read about that, and it's just not quite there. And likewise, for me, a stunning example is he had the same cinematographer for most of his career, but the guy's only mentioned once briefly in passing in the autobiography. The thing about the autobiography is it's a very long book, and it's very, very disappointing in many ways. We started to identify them. Because Chaplin was so obsessed with money, with business practices, the book actually does a great job of giving you to the dollar, to the penny, what he got in this contract, what he made there, negotiations. It's a great business autobiography that way. And it's also great in terms of name dropping, because he was the most famous man in the world and every famous person wanted to meet him. And I'm constantly like underlining and annotating, oh my God, he met so-and-so and so-and-so, you know, I love that. But it's at a certain point, it's kind of superficial, just, you know, all the famous people you meet at a party kind of thing and the names you can mention. Where it's most disappointing is twofold, that it's not always reliable in terms of his personal life. And then it's not always reliable really in terms of the filmography. And I mean, in this sense, he talks about film production in a kind of pragmatic, you know, business-oriented sense, marketing and so on. But there's very little in the autobiography about the creative process. I scribbled down some quotes from the book. They're among the few where he really talks about what he's trying to do with the role or what the tramp means to him. So again, in terms of that early start in what we call vaudeville, English music hall, what really got him to America was a man named Fred Karno, who had a touring company. And as early as 1910, and again, 1912, they came to the States for an extensive tour, not just the big cities, but all the out of the way places like Butte, Montana and so on, which will factor into the gold rush, actually, in terms of what you'd find in a frontier town. They toured everywhere. And it was really in that phase, the early teens, early to mid teens, that he starts to have a greater degree of confidence in himself as a performer, you know, what he can do on stage. And some of his early stage roles have nothing to do with the tramp. He plays all kinds of roles, but starting to work towards that. And then you and I can talk now about how he actually becomes the tramp, because that's really at the point where he's become known through theatrical touring, and that's going to lead to an entree to the movies, but specifically to making movies in America. He likes working in this country. He actually has reason to want to get out of England. Think about that grim upbringing, and to come to America. And he knows instinctually, and so much about Chaplin is instinctual as much as anything else. He knows this is the career he wants.
I think Mark Sennett offered him some, you know, it seemed like an ungodly amount of money at the time, $150 a week to come out to California and make some short movies with him. Of course, they didn't call them shorts at the time. They thought, you know, this was the state of the art. And Mark Sennett had that whole Keystone Cops kind of movie making that Charlie Chaplin was really perfect for, with this very physical comedy. When he sums up the character of the tramp, he says he cares about his work and about everything he does. And he says, if I could do something else better, I would do it, but I can't. The tramp is a gentleman, a poet, a dreamer, a lonely fellow, always hopeful of romance and adventures. That comes up over and over. He invented the tramp costume with Fatty Arbuckle's pants, Arbuckle's father-in-law's derby, Chester Conklin's cutaway, Ford Sterling's size 14 shoes, the diminutive Charles Avery's jacket, and some crepe paper belonging to Max Wayne, which became the tramp's mustache. The only item that actually belonged to Chaplin was the cane. And speaking of, sometimes he was very good to his friends. When Fatty Arbuckle was unable to find work after that infamous trial, Chaplin supported him out of his own pocket.
He did. Let's have dueling quotations here.
Okay, go for it, Mike.
Because we should linger on this point. How did the tramp become the tramp? So much in Chaplin's earliest career on stage and in movies was improvisation. You play before an audience, you play off the audience, you see what works. Once you have a routine down, then it becomes gelled at a certain point, right? But you're trying it out with the live crowd. And he's really, you know, into the kind of slapstick comedy that was so popular at that time. Very superficial, very, very silly kind of stuff. But how does he arrive at the character of the tramp? You very correctly identify where did the costume come from, all the components. He did not go in with a deliberate game plan, like I'm going to become a tramp because various demographic reasons or whatever. No, he wasn't like intellectually thinking that way. It was more a matter of they were, you know, going to shoot another movie and, you know, what should he wear? It's like going to the costume shop. And what your quote did a great job on was like, okay, I'll use this and I have it on this shelf. Oh, look at so-and-so's shoes or hat or whatever. And let me give the exact quote from Chaplin himself. This is one of the rare moments in his autobiography where he really opens up a bit about that creative process, what he was trying to do with the tramp. Here's what Chaplin says in his autobiography. Again, this was published in 1964, so he's thinking back decades earlier. I wanted everything a contradiction. The pants baggy, the coat tight, the hat small, and the shoes large. I was undecided whether to look old or young, but remembering Max Sennett had expected me to be a much older man when we first met, I added a small mustache, which I reasoned would add age to me without hiding my expression. I had no idea of the character, but the moment I was dressed, the clothes and the makeup made me feel the person he was. I began to know him, and by the time I walked onto the stage, he was fully born.
That is a really great quote, and it kind of gives you the idea of the process. So thanks for that. I do like this other quote where he says he entered a Charlie Chaplin lookalike contest and finished third. And in some version of the stories, he came in second. But it just goes to show how iconic that costume was. And, you know, underneath the makeup, it could have been anybody. It just happened to be Chaplin most of the time.
Now, when Chaplin, in the quote I gave, mentions that he wanted everything to be a contradiction, this is where he's starting to intellectualize it as to, well, what exactly does the tramp represent? First of all, in American culture at that time, tramps or hobos, as they sometimes were interchangeably called, were something that was a matter of public fascination and fear to some degree. In the late 19th century into the early 20th century, you had a lot of unemployed men who would wander the countryside. These are people who are outside of society, and especially after the financial panic of 1893, there was not the social welfare net we take for granted. Millions of people were out of work and desperate. A lot of guys were, you know, like riding the rails, as we'd say, you know, going from town to town, looking for work or not looking for work, just, you know, bumming around, as they would have said. These are people who maybe would have been inside society at one point, employed, families, all that, but now are outside society. They're not working. They're kind of desperate. Some of them do turn to crime. In any event, they are outsiders in the sense of they're out of work. They live on the outskirts of town. They live outdoors in a shack or in the fields, whatever. And if they come wandering through your neighborhood, you can imagine, you know, the kind of fear that people would feel sometimes. You know, is that bum going to, you know, steal something out of my yard? Is he going to knock on the door looking for food? So there was a kind of fear there and a kind of prejudice against the hobos, the tramps. But there also was a fascination. These are people who are outside of society and a degree of pathos and sympathy. So it's a kind of mixed response people have. And that's actually where it becomes romanticized. Like in some ways, if you're working a 9-to-5 job and everything's comfortable, maybe even a little boring, you can think, gee, what, not to have those worries, right? Just your sack on your back and you know, your feet on the road and the open sky and, you know, that kind of feeling. So it's a really rather mixed response. You see it reflected in literature and art, in the movies for sure, where you get these hobo characters as to how they're treated. Sometimes in an almost villainous way, as figures of fear, outsiders and kind of xenophobia, who's come into town kind of thing. But other times more just a kind of curiosity and maybe ironically an almost kind of envy. And so Chaplin's Tramp plays off of all those things. He's essentially sympathetic. You know, you don't get much of a backstory ever, really. I mean, how did he become a hobo? How did he get this way? No, very little. You get him in the present moment. And the clothes are, you know, those of a poor person, but not entirely. There are elements of costuming, aspects of it, that speak to a kind of aspiration. This is a tramp, but in some ways he's a dandy. He aspires to more. And in Chaplin's thinking, in the evolution of that character, he was very influenced. When he was working in English music halls, those music hall performers also toured in Europe, specifically in France. And in Paris, he would have seen the French equivalent, and he would have seen figures on stage, and he would have watched French movies. And there was a French comedian named Max Linder, who was extremely influential. He was a big deal in the early 19-teens. He came along before Chaplin. He played mostly dandyish characters, the top hat, the cane, you know, the tuxedo, and kind of foppish, kind of foolish, and basically a nice guy, but kind of silly and superficial and getting into trouble in all sorts of ways. Chaplin's Tramp character incorporates aspects of what Max Linder was doing. Some aspects of the clothing that you and I have talked about really speak more to a dandy or somebody who aspires to that. And also sometimes in his behavior, sometimes he is kind of snobbish and snooty in his own way as to how he responds to people. And moreover, even though he's basically a good guy, he occasionally will commit crimes. You could say sometimes they're crimes of survival, you know, to put food on the table. Sometimes there's a sadistic streak. The tramp will do things that are really kind of nasty, kind of mean, just because he enjoys it even, or payback, get back at the rich upper crust. There's a class consciousness there. That class consciousness was something imbued in Chaplin. Back to your opening observations, when you're born into that kind of poverty and you're struggling, particularly in Great Britain, you're aware of where you are and where you're not in society. And Chaplin throughout his life was conscious of that. And it's one reason why the tramp then could be a figure with which we can identify, whether we're poor or not, you know, this poor guy, what he does to get through life, through the world, there's that. But, you know, at various levels for Chaplin politically, why was he so sympathetic to communism? Why was he so far to the left that he got into a lot of trouble later on, personally and professionally? Well, he's thinking about where he's emotionally identifying. He's not always logically consistent. It's, again, an example of what we would nowadays call like a limousine liberal. I mean, he's extremely wealthy and, you know, all that, but his sympathies are with the poor. So all that gets built into, quite literally, the costuming for the character and the psychology of the character, if you will.
Now, of course, he's made a lot of movies, and we're not going to be able to talk about all of them. And we probably should talk about the Gold Rush, but since we're focusing on the tramp as a character, I'd like to mention my favorite Chaplin movie, which is 1931's City Lights, because of the fact that he does play the tramp in the movie, but his co-star is Virginia Cherryl, also, by the way, known as Cary Grant's first wife. And she's blind for most of the film. So she can't see the tramp. She doesn't see his clothing or the way he presents himself. What she sees is his inner nature, which is very kind and very generous. And that's what she falls in love with. But she doesn't recognize him later after she's had the operation to have her sight restored.
But you know what is fascinating here is if you watch the great two-reel comedies of the 19-teens, and you're right, there's so many of them, it's kind of hard to, you know, single out just a few. But in those earlier films, the tramp does oftentimes have a mean edge or a kind of sadistic edge by way of, you know, doing like kicking somebody in the pants or pulling a chair out or stealing somebody's money off the table, you know, things like that to survive, but also sometimes just to get back at the upper crust, at the snooty people. What happens in the early 1920s, specifically with his film The Kid in 1921, and then in The Gold Rush, 1925, Circus, 1928, City Lights, 1931, in the modern times, 36. And those films, those are the final feature films with the tramp character. Those films are much more consistently sentimental. His image, his presentation of the tramp becomes much sweeter, doesn't it? The tramp is almost an entirely good guy in the later films. That's not the way the tramp, it's almost like the evolution of Mickey Mouse, if you will. If you watch the first, you know, Walt Disney films, Mickey Mouse has a mean streak in him. You know, he looks more like a rat for one thing, right? He's got rodent features in the late 20s. And he also does some nasty stuff and says some rather rude things, right? But by the early to mid 30s, Mickey Mouse is so soft and lovable and a nice guy and all that. And I don't want to push the identification too far, the comparison, but with Chaplin, you can see a bit of evolution there in terms of how the tramp's being presented. Now, an issue that comes up is, you know, the movies discover sound in 1927. Chaplin is the only, here's an indication of what a great star he was, how popular. And we could spend a lot of time talking about this, but he was the most famous man in the world in the 19-teens and 20s. When he and Douglas Fairbanks went on what was called a Liberty Bond tour in 1918 to help support the American war effort, thousands and thousands of people would turn out to see them. Likewise, when Chaplin's schedule was published, which he didn't like, but if like the train itinerary was published, when he was publicizing The Kid in 1921 in this country and in England, I've never read anything quite like this in terms of tens of thousands of people turning up at train stations just to get a glimpse of him and just pandemonium. It's a level of celebrity that any other celebrity would envy, you know what I mean? Or maybe not envy when you know that there's a downside to it. But the fact that he was the most famous person in the world, well, what happens in the late 20s? Everyone else, whether they like it or not, has to adapt to sound. Chaplin was the great holdout, wasn't he? I mean, City Lights is released in 1931. It's at least 4 years after sound comes to Hollywood. Modern Times, 1936. These are his final silent pictures. And he was tenacious and he was able to do it. He had a huge following, a great public. They stayed with him through those fine, but he knew that he couldn't do that much beyond that. But here, I want to give another quote from Chaplin's autobiography where he talks about why he held out. You know, because actually, go back to his music hall origins. He was really very articulate. He did a lot of routines on stage that required his joking ability, his speaking ability, and he was a great mimic. He could, you know, and you see that later, like in Great Dictator and some, but I mean, you know, verbally versatile. So it wasn't a case like some silent stars just didn't have the voice or whatever. No, it wasn't that at all. He was, if anything, he talked a lot, right? But in the movies, no, he was silent. So here's what he said about why he felt he could still make City Lights as a silent picture. Here's Chaplin. A good silent picture had universal appeal, both to the intellectual and the rank and file. Now it was all to be lost, but I was determined to keep making silent films, for I believed there was room for all types of entertainment. Besides, I was a pantomimist, and in that medium I was unique and, without false modesty, a master. So I continued with the production of another silent picture, City Lights.
I don't think City Lights would be the same movie if it had sound. I'm glad he held the line. I think The Tramp is meant to be silent, even though you have the intertitles. I think City Lights is his best movie. I don't know what you would rank as his best for you, Mike, if you were going to tell our listeners to if you're just going to watch one.
Well, I always hate questions like that because then I'll give one and think, oh, but what about this and what about that? But I would agree with you in a qualified way. I'd probably say City Lights, but Modern Times is high on the list, certainly Gold Rush. Among the earlier two-reelers, the short films earlier, I would mention films like The Immigrant, for instance, The Rink, I mean, some of the really great films from the team. So I'd want to take that one film choice and say, does it have to be only one? But yeah, put into a bind that way. City Lights, you know, I think probably would be my choice as well. And then what happens is with still making silent films, by the time he makes Modern Times 5 years later, and this is a point in the career where he typically will take 4 or 5 years to make a film, you know, as opposed to those early films, which were knocked out, like, you know, in a few days. We could talk about that as well. But by the time he does Modern Times, he is incorporating at least sound effects. He's working in, it was City Lights and then more so in Modern Times, you know, to at least get sound that way. So there's a soundtrack that's deliberately there. And Chaplin was very savvy about music throughout his career. So he's thinking about music and sound effects. He holds off on direct dialogue through the mid-30s. Nobody else in America, in Hollywood, I mean, could really have that kind of clout, but Chaplin did it. Both those films were box office hits.
Speaking of being super famous, when he makes the movie The Great Dictator, which of course was meant to send up the Nazi regime, when he was informed that Hitler sat through two screenings of it, he said, "I'd give anything to know what he thought of it." And wouldn't that have been interesting to know?
It would be fascinating. It's just something we can wonder about but never really know, because it's a devastating depiction of Hitler. It's such a mockery. It's such a close... Yeah, and Chaplin was so gifted at imitating other people. And actually, ironically, and in fact, in biographies of Chaplin, this is pointed out, Kenneth Lynn in his biography notes that they are almost exact contemporaries, Hitler and Chaplin. And also in terms of some of the poor origins, the sense of bitterness about that early hard struggle and so on, even though obviously politically they're at opposite ends of the spectrum, some of those origins are quite similar. And Chaplin was absolutely obsessed with politics. And by the late 19-teens, he was among the Americans who were really intrigued by the Russian Revolution and who really were, you know, very sympathetic to the new communist government. It would get Chaplin in some trouble back then after World War I and a lot of trouble after World War II. But the fact that, you know, he had that political fascination. So it's not at all surprising that when he makes his first all-talking picture, Great Dictator, that, you know, in that period, and again, we're in the very late 30s into the 40s where World War II is just getting underway, that he would not only turn to contemporary subject matter, but himself would play, you know, a figure who's directly meant to be Adolf Hitler, Admiral Hinkle. And so, you know, you realize in a film like that, it's absolutely devastating depiction. And again, how skilled he was as a pantomimist, because again, it's a talking picture, but so much of the comedy is still physical, isn't it? It's the way in which you get, I call it a full body performance, like head to toe, every gesture, every move, every bit of costuming, as you mentioned before, it's all been thought out that way, whether improvised on the set or really thought out and scripted, it's there and he's really perfected it, he's finessed it. So by the time you see the completed film, Great Dictator, everything's locked in place. You watch it, you know, that famous ballet sequence where he's bouncing the world. I mean, that's something that's so exceptionally gifted that the dancers always talk about how much they admired Chaplin. In fact, in the late 19-teens, Nijinsky, the great Nijinsky, knew Chaplin. Of course, every famous person knew him, right? And Nijinsky, you know, told him that he thought that Chaplin had, like, you know, the perfect moves of a dancer, of a great dancer. And you see that, and that's one reason why Chaplin, he's often faulted for being technically, if not crude, at least functional as a director, you know, and which is true. He's no great shakes, technically speaking, as a film director, with a few rare exceptions of remarkable shots, but those are the exceptions. For the most part, it's just, you know, present the action, shoot it straight on. But one reason why he did that was he's thinking as he would on stage. It's a full body performance, what's sometimes called head to toe. If the actor's doing something really funny, it's a physical performance and you don't want to have it cropped. You want to see it head to toe, almost like in the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers films. They're at their best when you see them full figure, right? When you really see them head to toe. And it might just be functional framing. You almost imagine a proscenium arch over them, right? But it works because the performance is so great. And Chaplin in The Great Dictator and throughout his career, oftentimes would have that figure presented in such a way that you really do see all of the figure and then very selectively going to close-ups or cutaway shots.
You know, it's worth mentioning that Douglas Fairbanks and Charlie Chaplin and Mary Pickford founded their own film company, United Artists, and at the time it was considered very radical and the inmates were running the asylum. But they did kind of strike out on their own, and that was very unusual for its time. United Artists today, by the way, is owned by Tom Cruise. Another thing about Fairbanks, coming back to the movie Chaplin, there's a wonderful moment in the film where Kevin Kline, as Douglas Fairbanks, tells Chaplin that he thinks that Adolf Hitler has stolen his act, you know, with the mustache and everything. So coming back to that movie, you do get to see Geraldine Chaplin playing her own grandmother, but she's done some other things, and I believe you've met her as well. Isn't that right, Mike?
I have actually. Some years ago, I met Geraldine Chaplin at the American Film Institute in Silver Spring. Richard Schickel helped put together a new documentary film about Chaplin. She was there to introduce it. And had a chance to talk with her immediately afterwards. And in her career, there were things I wanted to ask her about. She had worked extensively with and lived with the Spanish director Carlos Saura, and they made some really strong films together. But also, ironically, coincidentally, I'd just been teaching a course at Howard Community College where we were watching Robert Altman's Nashville. And she has a great, great character that she plays there. And so we were talking about that. As I was, you know, standing with her and talking to her, I was, you know, taking her in, and I was thinking about the fact that I could see the resemblance to Chaplin, but even more so to her mother. Her mother, Una, was the daughter of the playwright Eugene O'Neill, and you can really see it in the facial features and so on. And considering the long shadow that was cast by her father, Geraldine was able to forge a career of her own. I mean, you know, when you see her in the Carlos Saura films or Altman's films or any number of other films she's been in, she really has her own presence as an actor. You can never shake the fact that every time you see her on screen, yeah, at some point you think, that's Charlie Chaplin's daughter. I mean, you can never entirely get away from that, and that's just the way it is. But you know what? She's a really gifted actor on her own. And even though Chaplin had a really checkered romantic life, and we could spend hours talking about that, when he finally married Una, that was his fourth wife, and again, Chaplin liked younger women. When he married Una, he was 54 when they married. She was 18. So, you know, he got older and the women stayed really young. But, you know, all joking aside there, that marriage lasted. They had 8 children together. They lived comfortably on his estate in Switzerland. And there was a degree of stability there. And if anything, he became more conservative in a kind of paterfamilias way, that he had his family and they were close. And he still performed for them. The grandchildren tell wonderful stories. So does Geraldine about Chaplin putting on performances at birthday parties, and he'd get dressed up and he would do the dance of the dinner rolls and all that stuff. He still had all the routines down pat. There wasn't a public audience at that point, but at least the immediate family was there.
The last quote I want to leave our audience with, because it's just so true, is that it isn't the ups and downs that make life difficult, it's the jerks, which kind of encompasses the attitude he brings with all of his roles, but certainly with the Tramp. But that brings us to the end of our sequence. Highly recommend watching the movie Chaplin, directed by Richard Attenborough, where you can see the arc of Charlie Chaplin's life. It's also a great performance by Robert Downey Jr. Also, don't forget to check out our other episodes on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.